Welcome to Women in WP, a bi-monthly podcast about women who blog, design, develop, and more in the WordPress community.
This episode is sponsored by Sandhills Development. If you're not familiar with them, they are the minds behind plugins such as Easy Digital Downloads, Restrict Content Pro, and Affiliate WP, plugins that many of us have used. But the reason that they are sponsoring this episode is because they are looking for a junior development and they are committed to diversity on their team. So some of the features that they are offering in their junior developer job is a minimum starting salary of $45,882. And I love that they actually put the salary on this job, because don't you guys see it when you go and you look for a job and you click through, oh, this looks interesting, no salary. It's like, why are you hiding the salary? Is it because you don't want to pay me as much as somebody else? I don't know. So other benefits include paid parental leave, full health insurance, charitable donations.
Yeah, I also like just the sense of the company culture at Sandhills, because they have, I love this, a subscription for coffee, wine, or beer delivered regularly to your front door, and unlimited paid sick leave and flexible vacation, which is fully paid, and required minimum time offs. Like, they really have that sense of work-life balance. They're not going to be someone who's going to expect you to be at your seat, you know, from this time you got to clock in and clock out. That they realize that people are humans, they need to take a break and go work out.
Yeah, and I know a lot of the people there, and they really are truly just wonderful people, everyone that I've met from there. And when they say that they're looking for to expand diversity, and like, they really mean it, and it's not just to fill a number. It's they are very much willing to grow and change and learn as well as teach. So I fully support. I think this is a great opportunity for someone.
So if you're looking for a position or thinking about making a change, check out their website. I'm going to put it in the show notes, sandhillsdev.com/careers, and you can find out more about the offerings they have. Welcome to episode 24 of Women in WP. I'm Amy Masson.
I'm Angela Bowman.
I'm Tracy Epps.
And our guest today is Monique Doubleman, who builds websites for small businesses and has been working in WordPress for 10 years. And she also teaches individuals, groups, and university students. Welcome, Monique.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the invite.
And we always start off our show by asking our guests to tell us their path into WordPress. So we would love it if you could share your story.
Right, I'll try and do the short version because I can elaborate on this. As you said, I started working professionally 10 years ago, and I've noticed that my story is, I can compare it to a lot of people. The crisis hit me hard back then. I come from a background in the printing industries, and I've been doing that until I was around 30, and then I wanted something new. So I moved to a rural side of the Netherlands, and I started my own web shop in organic gardening. And that was something people didn't need anymore when the crisis hit the Netherlands. So my income went like that. And then I thought, how can I make money? So I went back to doing graphical design, and I've been doing web design on the side since the 90s, just for fun and for friends and for my own blogs. And with the web shop, I already had a blog on WordPress.com. So doing it professionally for me, knowing the WordPress interface, was a logical choice to go for that. So that's how it went.
And so you started just building them for friends, and how did that grow into a business?
Well, the building website for friends or doing logo design and graphical design, that was all like static websites. That was just HTML and CSS. So I've had my practice with web design in a non-professional way. When I decided to start doing web design professionally, I just reached out to people and say like, I have a problem. I need money. I need clients. So I want to start doing it professionally. And if you know someone or need a website, come to me, please. And then I had 3 or 4 people saying, we want that. So
how did you make that transition from WordPress.com to WordPress, self-hosted WordPress. And what was that like for you and what factored into that?
Well, I think back then, both the .com, I didn't move sites from .com to the self-hosted. So that blog I had was on .com. And then I looked into how should I self-host a website. So I already had experience with uploading static websites to hosting companies. So I was familiar with that part. So I guess I asked around on Twitter first what people use and how they did things to confirm, like, should I go with WordPress or maybe Drupal or even Joomla or whatever, what I was using at the time. So I was familiar with uploading, and I don't think the hosting companies back then had the service like the one-click install going like, press here and we'll install WordPress for you. So I think I just downloaded a WordPress version from the Dutch WordPress website that I found and then uploaded and installed MySQL server and stuff like that. And it was a lot of reading. it took
Did it
effort.
Take 5 minutes?
You know the answer to that question, I guess. No, definitely not. It still doesn't, though. Well, if you have a good hosting, it can take 5 minutes because they take care of all the database and stuff like that. But if you're really not technical and you have to deal with all that,
So is your education in design and art?
Well, I did what they call in the Netherlands, like sort of middle technical graphical education, which is actually focused on engineering, on printing. But the actual training I did, I learned how to print. I learned how to do darkroom work for photography.
Darkroom stuff. You smell like those chemicals for months. I'm sure it's terrible for you.
But it was so fun. And then you would sort of make all these like contacts and do like lighting, and we're in the dark room for 3 hours, and then the final thing came out and you had flipped one film and you had to start over again. So it was a profession. So I loved doing all the handwork. But what happens in the end is it was actually meant that we ended up in sort of management functions after that education. So we learned all the techniques. I learned Photoshop 1.0 back in school. I saw the mini apples come. So I learned all that, but in the end, I ended up making proposals and managing people because I had this level of education. So I was very creative, went to creative school and ended up in a non-creative job. So that's why I sort of did it on the side. So I learned graphical design. I learned, you know, typefacing and stuff like that, typography, but I never practiced it professionally before I started doing this full time.
So, I know you did something about with code for 100 days, right?
So not yet.
But like, what inspired that? Like, how have you gotten into someone like, I do like the graphic design and I want to learn how to code. Like, what kind of things have you found that's really helped you?
At the moment, to build websites or?
Just anything, like about, you know, like how you committed to, I was just gonna do code every day or whatever that.
Right. Well, I know HTML and CSS. So I've been doing that since the 90s. So for me, well, I don't know CSS in a modern form or broad way because it's evolved a lot since the 90s. So I know how to apply. How this actually started is that last year, 2 years ago, when I got to know CSS Grid, I saw it. And for me, this was so logical. I thought like, oh, this looks like designing for prints. So I can deal with this. But getting your head around the technique of CSS Grid and new CSS techniques, for me, I was more focusing on content and marketing and how you should use your website instead of, so I used standard templates and focused on how to fill up the website instead of going for a nice red color or good layouts. But with CSS Grid, I got really enthusiastic again about design. And I think for about a year and a half, whenever people mentioned CSS Grid, I said, oh, CSS Grid is really cool. I really want to start learning doing that. And I did that for a year and a half. And then at some point, I thought, I better stop saying and actually start doing it. But you've got, when should you do it? I mean, you've got time. What kind of courses do you take? And on Twitter, I saw this challenge for 100 days of code. And there was a sort of New Year's resolution. And I saw that while I was off work around Christmas. And I sort of, then you just tweet, I publicly commit to 100 days of code without knowing what I'm actually going to do. But then I decided to make work of it and go for it. And the idea is actually that you commit an hour a day to coding. And for me, because I really wanted to learn CSS Grid, I looked at a Udemy course I found that explained it really well and got me really enthusiastic about going on. Yeah, so I started on the January 1st. So if you would count 70 days from that on, I should have been done, let's say, two and a half months, so somewhere in March, and we're past the summer now, so I haven't finished it yet, and I'm not really committing to it like every day, and when I'm traveling I can't do it, and on the weekends I don't, but it's good to have, you know, a regular pace to because otherwise you have to start over again and look into your course again and go, then what was I doing? So I try to do it every weekday. I like it.
I remember when I first started my company, because I started my company when the recession hit here in the States, and like the day after, I just, you know, filed for an LLC. And I, at the beginning, I had sticky notes like everywhere to remind me of that one day a week I was going to like learn something or do something that like I wanted to do and not client work, something that wasn't billable or whatever. And I think that then I got away from it. And then I like fell behind on a lot of stuff. So like that, I like that, you know, committing to learning something for 100 days. Like, I think that gives you like a nice, you know, like, okay, well, here's my goal and something measurable that you can say you've achieved, but you can say like one day a week, I'm going to learn CSS Grid. Like that kind of stuff is, I think, really helpful for anyone who's in a creative industry.
Yeah, for me as well, because I don't know, I think most people that work in WordPress sort of are self-taught. So you learn as you go. So you only cherry pick what you need. That's how it works for me and what I've learned from other people as well. But you don't really fully understand. At some point, you're just applying stuff. I can apply PHP, but I don't really understand webhooks and stuff like that. So but I manage. I mean, the websites work and, you know, they're findable in Google and the clients are happy. But for me with CSS, alongside learning CSS Grid, now it's so much fun to actually sort of understanding. I also get to learn a lot of tools and building processes, like learning SAS and processing, and new code editors and stuff like that. So I learn a lot of things alongside. And what you said about not doing client work for one day, that's how I started as well, because I've been printing or in the printing industry and always doing client work. And I really wanted something inspirational. So in the beginning, I had my Wednesdays off and I did non-production work, just fun stuff, creative stuff, whatever inspired me. And in 2013, I decided I wanted to learn something on a certain level, because I never got my degree and that sort of kept following me. So I decided to get a degree, but then it was just full-time work, doing part-time study, getting a degree, and I didn't even have a social life. So the whole creative thing fell through back then. And yeah, actually, this sort of helps me picking up again the habit of not working on clients, but doing something to learn myself new stuff. And it gives me a lot of inspiration as well. And I sort of get to see the bigger picture now, because I fill in the gaps that I skipped before because I was just cherry picking.
Oh, yeah. I remember, because I also self-taught and I taught myself HTML back in 96, whatever, that's when I started. And so like I knew how to do things, but I didn't know that it was called a tag. You know, like, so those kinds of things, especially when I was starting to, when I was teaching at the university level. And then I was like, oh, that's what it's called. There's a name for that. Oh, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, ditto for me. Once I started teaching classes, it's like, oh yeah, this is a selector and this is the property. So you also teach. Has that, what do you teach?
Yeah, I teach as a freelancer at the Amsterdam University of Applied Sciences. And this is in a bachelor degree for information science. That's what it used to be. It comes from a background of archive and library studies, but now they're sort of connecting to the online world. So now it's called, when I did it, it was media information communication, and now it's called digital business. And the subject I'm teaching is called content management or digital media. And they, in 7 weeks, they have to know what WordPress is, how to use it. And but actually, it's more content organization, information design. So they have to learn how to make templates for certain post types. So if you're, for instance, make a recipe, what kind of parts do you post have, and how do you tag it, how do you categorize it, how do you make it findable and usable? So they learned that. And the other thing is that they had to learn how to prototype. So I taught them how to make prototypes in XD, which was great fun. And it's also interesting because I taught them a bit about accessibility as much as I could squeeze in. And these were all like 17, 18 years old. So like, oh, why should I design a website for a blind person? The classical remark, if you don't know it, you don't know it. And I was doing it at the beginning of this year, and there was a cause back then that Beyonce got sued because her website was not accessible for blind people.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
And Domino's is still fighting that lawsuit over it.
Yeah, it's what I learned is that actually the lawsuits now, they're not really to make the web accessible, but for people to make money out of people not having an accessible website. That's how I understood it from the US, which is a wrong reason for a good cause or something like that.
That's what we do a lot in the US.
Yeah,
well, litigious.
I'm absolutely pro accessible websites. I'm not for lawyers who try to make money out of it without, you know, good ethics. But yeah, it was funny. In every class I was teaching accessibility as part of what for me is a basics for designing. They said, like, how can a blind person go on the internet anyway? They just didn't know. So I think that's where it starts. When you go into teaching, teachers need to make design students understand why this is important. So yeah, still a lot of work to do, I think.
Yeah, I think we have a long way to go in terms of accessibility, especially in the US. What are the things when you're talking to your students, your 17 and 8-year-olds, about accessibility and you're explaining, because, you know, they don't understand, it doesn't occur to them. And I get that when you're young, you know, the whole world's revolving around you. What are the things that, the top things you tell them that they need to make sure they're doing on their websites?
So from a design perspective, things that are easy to grasp for them, contrast. I let them check their contrast, and I also let them experience what it's like if you're in the sun or with a light on your screen, so they can actually see that it can be good for themselves as well. So contrast, also not depend on icons only or on color only. So I had an example with forms where it's not only set a color and then set it to monochrome, you know, one side, and then have an example where there were icons with a V and a cross to say like, oh, it's not much effort to do it this way, but it makes it easier for everyone to understand. Also a lot of things about readability, like length of, you know, how many characters on a line are easy to read. And still they came up with full screen, like 40 pixel text, no margin. Yeah, it's a lot of information for them to digest, but I sort of stuck to those things because going even deeper was way too much to get their head around.
So you also own your own company and do this. Is there a certain like niche that you found, or like some spot, like a sweet spot that you kind of fell into?
Well, I'm a generalist, so I tend to do a lot of things, not on a very specialist level, but on a broad level. But the one thing I come across, and I'm actually currently exploring and diving more and more into, is information design and content design. And I have decided I refuse to build websites that don't have content in place, because lorem ipsum isn't good for anyone. So I want to focus more on helping companies writing good content and understandable content for users, and design that in a way that there's a hierarchy and that you get, you know, the right information in the right place. Yeah,
and you
I don't
have
know
a
how.
Lot of WordPress. You have a lot of WordPress.tv talks.
Yeah,
I mean,
on
like
information.
You've spoken a lot of Word. Yeah, yeah. You've spoken at a lot of WordCamps about content organization and information. What do you feel like people should, what are the biggest takeaways from the talks that you've given on those?
The biggest takeaway, I think, what is good for people to know that you have to design for what's not there yet. So think in systems instead of current information. And because what you find a lot on websites when you go around, there's like, oh, we've got three items, so we sell, I don't know, peaches, cherries, and apples. And they go under a category fruit. And at some point they decided to sell, I don't know, cabbage as well. Which sort of is out of place, and they don't know where to put it, because it would be weird to make a category called vegetables because there's only cabbage in there or something like that. So people don't think ahead of what information might end up on their website in the future. So I think that's a good thing to start from.
I really like that you said that, because that's one of the things of like when I, you know, talk to potential clients or someone that's looking to like do their website or whatever, and they don't know what to do, and they're like, well, I can just install this template, and or go with like, you know, this college student that wants to do a website, and they're just going to install a template and change some colors. But what I say is, especially with businesses, like you, if you have a business, most people, I would think, want to grow it. And so if you don't have that kind of planning of how the website will grow along with it, you get all of these things like people that, like, I made this site on Wix or whatever, all those other ones, right? And then they're like, oh, and then we added a bunch of stuff, and now I'm like, I don't know how to, I can't update it, I can't do any of that stuff. So I think it's like really important. I'm glad that you are speaking about those things, because that's something that like a lot of people just, they're not aware of, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, also with content, like for me, it's so logical to have like both content and design in one view, because
back in
the days when I was younger, but in the printing industry, you're not designing without content. You get your text, you get your headings, you get your images, you get your text, and then you start designing. It's not that I say make a design and you get the text at some point, because if you have, I don't know, a heading of three words that are a certain length, and you start designing that, it's going to look so much different if you have a different heading in place or not the real heading. And I think that's the problem a lot of people stumble upon when they download a standard template from a pre-made template, that you actually start filling the design. So you build your content inside the design instead of designing around the content, and then you get these footers with, I don't know, weird things in them because they have to put something in there and they don't know what. So let's make something up.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because yes, we want to separate, like, at least technically wise, we separate design from the content. That's what a whole content management system is. But I like print that, like, the content is a part of the design. Like, yeah, it's absolutely, like, and you look at some of these websites, a lot of the, like, the long form stuff from the, some of these old printing, they're starting to take those elements and making these, like, experimental and, like really cool immersive stories with using the content as a design and vice versa, which I think is really impressive and really nice.
Yeah, and it's also really nice to look at how newspapers who come from a very classical background and sort of start looking at their content differently when viewed online. Because I remember the newspaper we read, or my partner reads, I sort of scan because I'm not really a good newspaper person. But in the beginning, if we would wanted to read it digital, we just would download a PDF and flip through the PDF. And now there's a sort of connection between the online articles, and you can still flip through the newspaper like it would be a small newspaper on your iPad, you know, the printed version. But when you click on an article, it sort of changes to something that's much nicer on an iPad, and it's got all the functionality and videos and stuff that you can, you know, actually exploit or take advantage of because you're online. So I think it's slow, and I'm not sure, because you see newspapers sort of mimic the old newspaper online. I'm not sure if that's what we want. We don't want to mimic print online because it's a different experience. But it's still interesting to see and translate. I'm not quite sure how to do that myself, because I've got this sort of, you know, relation to print. It may be interesting to see how the digital or the millennial kids look at these things. They're not used to print for most of what they read.
Well, when I remember seeing a talk many, many years ago, and it was talking about how when we first got motion pictures, and, like, all of the motion pictures look like plays, because that's what we knew. So we just kind of translated it into this new medium until we realized, oh, wait, we can do all these other things. Okay, so, like, but we still can take some of those pieces of that, you know, like pieces of the newspaper with the, you know, kind of really cool design and, like, integrating all that together, but taking advantage of the technology that we have. And then also just thinking through, like, when you talk, make the connection with accessibility, there's so many ways that this, you can make this, like, a great experience for everyone.
Yeah, not for some users.
Well, I would love to ask you, I know that you are involved in the WordPress community in the Netherlands, and I would love to hear more about what it's like to be a part of that community in the Netherlands.
Okay. Well, I'm fairly new to the WordPress community, actually, and I wish I'd discovered it earlier in my career, because I've been working with WordPress since, yeah, around 2010 or 2009. And the first 5 or 6 years, it was just me behind my computer struggling and finding all these solutions. And around 2015, I had a friend telling me about meetups, and I said, well, what's a meetup? And she said, you're my geek friend. You don't know about meetups. And I said, no. I was living in a rural area back then. We had the internet, but still, I mean, there was no one telling me this existed. So I found this WordPress meetup in Rotterdam, where I originally came from, and I went there, and it was really nice how I felt welcomed by all these people I didn't know. And there were two speakers, and they were sharing knowledge, and it was really nice. And I was talking to people, and they said, like, oh, we've got WordPress the Netherlands, you should come to that. It's like a meetup, but bigger. And I was going, like, yeah, but I'm not a developer. That's like a classic story. I think every designer or content manager or whoever's not a developer says, and she said, yeah, but there's all kinds of people, just come. So in 2015, I went to my first work camp in the Netherlands, and that was great. I still got like friends from that first work camp. And from that on, well, I went to Work Camp Europe in Vienna, and then 2017, I started speaking at Work Camps, and I got more and more involved. We don't have a national Work Camp anymore because Work Camp Central changed their policy, so we got some city Work Camps. But it's nice. The Netherlands are fairly small, so I know most active people in the community, and we've got some strong voices, people with good knowledge. Yeah, it's nice, and people are very open to sharing what they know and help you out. And yeah, I've made some good friends here. And I organize a meetup myself with Rianne Rietveld. She's known by quite a few people for her accessibility talks and her work for the accessibility team for WordPress. And at the moment, I live in Amsterdam, and I'm sort of revamping the Amsterdam community, which is non-existent at the moment, but I'm working on it and see if we can do some more here. So it's good. Yeah.
I'm always so fascinated to hear about the different communities in all the different countries that people are able to get involved with and find support and, you know, find their people. Where I live, there's not really a meetup anywhere within, you know, 70 miles. So I'm kind of on my own. So when I get the opportunity, I really like to go to the word camps that I can, just so I can talk to my people.
Are you the only WordPress person in your town?
I think there are other WordPress people. We just don't know each other. There's like an open source community, and I don't tend to go to that. Although I know the people there and I'm invited. It's just they're not really talking about WordPress. They're just talking about any open source stuff. And so it's not typically of interest to me, but I don't know. There's not like any organized group of WordPress people in my town. I should look into starting that.
You can set your own. Yeah, that's how it started with me, because we always have the idea, like, you can cross the Netherlands within 3 hours, you know? So why add something new? Because there are so many already. But still, people tend to stick to their own town. I mean, cycling in Amsterdam for half an hour is okay, but taking the train somewhere for half an hour is like, it's kind of far away. And I do the meetup in Leiden with Rian now for 2 years. And we were hesitant in starting it because there's one in Rotterdam, which is like 20 minutes away. There's one in Utrecht, it's less than half an hour away. And we were like, should we start another one? And Remkes de Vries, who is known by quite a few people in the WordPress community, he sort of got things going here at a very early stage. I think he originated the first WordCamp Europe in the Netherlands. And he said, just do it. Just go for it. If you have only 5 people, or if you have only the two of you, then it's still a meetup. You can still share knowledge and get together and do things. And so we said, oh, let's do it. Let's just start one. And we started one, and I don't know if I or Rian spoke at the first one. We had another one, and we had full house. We set the limit to 30, and it was full in 1 day. And then we set it to 50, and it was full in 2 days. So, yeah, and we do it 4 times a year. I mean, it doesn't have to be monthly, I think. And yeah, we get good response, and we're going to do it for the third year. And we didn't think we could add anything to what was already there. So I think, yeah, you can always start one. I think WordCamp Central is very supportive in helping out, like what you should look for, and, you know, yeah, go for it.
Interesting. Okay. That's going to go on my to-do list of things to consider adding to my already overflowing plate.
Because you have so much extra free time. We all do, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
But it's fun as well. It energizes. I think what we decided, like, after every evening, we go like, did this give us energy? Yes. And then, you know, it's you can put as much effort or as little effort into it. The basic things is finding a location, set a date. And in Amsterdam, nothing has happened since 2016. And I didn't even know people from the community here. So I just said, oh, let's just organize drinks. I mean, we can hold a glass. That's what we can. And so I organized a drink in July, and we had 40 people showing up, and we just networked. We told, what do you do? What do you do? We had a drink. I mean, that's not much effort to organize. So, and yeah.
I like the measure of, did this give me energy, or did this, you know, did this feed me? Because that, I'm going to use that.
Yeah, and I feel that way with our meetups. I organize 2 meetups a month, with, and sometimes 3. I had to drop okay. the third one for a while. But the I didn't know if I should do it, you know, take it on, because my friend was stepping down. But when I did take it on, I realized it did give me a lot of energy, and I was able to invite speakers I wanted to hear come speak, and I could learn the things I wanted to learn. And so it's like been very self, I don't know, a little bit selfish in a way, because it's like, oh yeah, I want someone to come talk about accessibility because I want to learn more about that. So I have control. I can get that person in here. So it's kind of awesome. And it does draw people. I've been surprised by how many people end up coming, and especially when you have like outside speakers and things like that.
Yeah, and it's changed a bit as well since there's the dashboard widget. We have a lot of first timers every meetup, because people see it end up in their WordPress dashboard, so that helps as well. You get to decide. Well, we try to include the people who come, because it's not our party. I mean, we sort of make it our party, but it's not. And I'm organizing it with Rianne, and she's a strong accessibility advocate. So we get a lot of accessibility talks, and sometimes I have to sort of, you know, go like, Rianne, it's a WordPress meetup, not an accessibility meetup. So try to put in other topics as well. But it's good. It's good. I mean, yeah, there's so many things to learn, even when you're in for a long time.
And I was going to ask Monique about how many business people come to the meetups. People, because Amy was mentioning she doesn't know how many WordPress developers are in her city, but that there's so many businesses who have WordPress sites who like to come to meetups because they want to learn things. And what's your experience with that? And would that be encouraging to Amy to start her meetup?
Yeah, it's what we've noticed, it really depends on what kind of speakers you invite, what kind of audience you get. And I think you shouldn't only fix on developers. I mean, WordPress users, I don't know what the numbers are, but there are a lot of people who use WordPress in a practical way. It's just a vessel, you know, it's not an end goal. So what we've noticed when we invite people come and talk on SEO, or people come talk on content strategy or marketing, we get a lot of business owners as well, or people like solopreneurs who have to do a lot of technical stuff themselves because they don't have a big budget. So depending on the speakers, we also get non-technical people in our meetup, which is good, because sometimes they ask you the next time to do their website when they have a little more money. So it's good for self-profiling as well.
Well, you and Angela have both mentioned, you know, great pulling in great speakers to come to your meetups. Then my next question, of course, is how do you find the speakers?
Okay, we have a good network. I'm doing this with Rianne, and we know quite a lot of people, but we also, what we did this year to take a bit of the stress away is decide on the beginning of the year, what kind of topics do we have in WordPress or in, you know, dealing with websites, and what would we like to cover? So we do 4 meetups a year, so we need 8 speakers, because we do 2 per evening. And we decide like, oh, we could do something on speed, we could do something on safety, we could do something on marketing, SEO, and then we go like, oh, who do we know? You know, who talks about this topic, or who have we seen at a WordCamp or stuff like that. So last year, for instance, one speaker fell through the last minute. That moment, 2 companies in the Netherlands had won the Automatic Design Award. So we managed, I sort of got on like Twitter DM straight away with one of the owners of the company who won the awards, got like, do you want to be on our meetup? And he said, yes, like 3 days in advance. So, and that was, I think, the most people we had in our audience. I don't know, but yeah, sometimes we're sort of lucky that we sort of know how to reach out to the people at the right moment. But we try to work in advance, and we're probably going to sit together in January and think for the next four meetups what topics we want to cover, and maybe ask our audience as well, because we also want to encourage people to start speaking. I'm going to do the Jill Binder diversity speaker workshops as well, to encourage like new speakers to come and speak. We don't really want all seasoned, you know, WordPress celebrities in our meetup to just for the audience. We'd like to be a stage for new people as well.
And you can have people remotely participate.
I was just about to ask that.
Sorry, what was the question?
Well, what I was going to say is that, you know, I have a big network. I know a lot of people in the industry, but I don't know anybody local that would come to my meetup and talk. So, you know, do you ever do remote speakers?
We haven't done that yet because the travel distances are so small. And in the city that we organize it in, I think there's a university, there's always 30 to 50 people who want to attend, and there's always a speaker in the area. I think the longest distance someone's traveled was an hour and a half, so that should be okay. But yeah, remote could definitely be a possibility. I think if you just put a Zoom thing online and we've got good internet everywhere. I did do some broadcasting via YouTube Live, so it probably works the other way around as well. Yeah.
All right. Well, it has been really great having you on today. And before we go, can you tell everybody where they can find you online?
I can be found online on Twitter at BOEMEDIA, so Boo Media, and boomedia.eu or .nl is my website names as well.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter, or join our Facebook group. We would be honored if you subscribe to the show. You can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and iTunes. Finally, if you want to be on the show or know someone who would, visit our website at womeninwp.com. Until next time.